Okay, next to me here is the Parthenon in Rome. Actually got to go there once. That picture looks kind of big. It's not as big as the picture makes it look, I don't think, but it's an interesting building. The word means of or relating or common to all the gods. Pan meaning all, and the Theon having the gods or the service of the gods. And I got this picture here because as I've studied the Bible over the last 30 years or so, I've studied it longer than that, but I've had a focus in the last 30 years or so of trying to understand the world that the Bible was written in, and I tell you that all the time. But it's always true that I want to understand what the world was like. And so I learn as much as I can. Of course, I'm not there, and some of the people that are writing about it, they weren't there either, but then they look at the original documents and do the best they can. And there's one thing about the ancient world that, no matter how much I study it, it's still difficult for me to really grasp because of the world that we live in now. Now we have, of course, the Parthenon there in Athens. And the thing that's difficult for me, and maybe you don't even think about it, or maybe it's not difficult for you, but in the ancient world, religion was not a separate activity or a separate interest from regular or daily life. In fact, I had a question as I was leaving Lewistown this morning. Somebody asked a question, and that was part of my answer because of the way the question was worded. That because the question had to do with certain practices that are described in the Bible, and sometimes we have trouble getting to the context, like what's going on. And one of the contexts of that world is the reality of the gods in general on their lives, their everyday lives. I told you this before, but I learned that even when I went to Thailand. It's still that way in some parts of the world. And I'm sure I've said it, but the one time I got off a plane, then I had to arrange some transportation. And because the time before I had a disaster trying to get to my hotel. So this time I hired one ahead of time. And there's somebody holding a sign up with my name on it, which felt good. Yeah, somebody looking out for me. And she asked me if I want to go to the temple. And I didn't have good hearing aids then. I didn't know what she was saying, but I wasn't expecting that. It's kind of like if you're not really expecting something, you wonder if you heard it right. So I asked her two or three times. It was clear she was saying, do you want to go to the temple? And I had no idea why she was asking me that. And I said, no, it's fine. Thank you. And I had to ask later, like, why? Why would you ask, do I want to go to the temple? And the answer is because in that culture, you have gods that are in charge of different regions, county, whatever the districts are called. They have cities, and then they have, the place where I stayed was in Chiang Mai, but that was a city and what we would call a county or a district or something. And that place has its own temple, and that temple has its own god. And if you want to come there and do something, although I was landing in Bangkok, I guess she doesn't know what I want to do. Maybe I'm there to try to make some money. I have a business, or I'm there to try to teach, or I'm there running for an office, or so. I wouldn't be running for an office in Thailand. But she knows I'm there to do something. And the assumption is that if you're there to do something, you wouldn't try to do it without getting the gods on your side first. That's just, they don't have to think twice about that. That's the way it is. And that was very strange to me at the time, whatever year that was, I don't remember, sometime in the 2010s. And then I go and you apply that back to the time of the Bible. The whole world was that way. It wasn't just this area here or that area there. In the world, the ancient world, the gods were real. And they were involved in everyday life. They understood that some gods are more powerful than others. If Sparta went to the battle with Athens, you had your armies trained and you had you had your strategies and all that. But in the general mind of the people, If Sparta won, it's because the Spartan gods were stronger than the Athenian gods, or vice versa. That just went without saying. Everybody understood it that way. The gods were real, and some were more powerful than others. All gods, no matter who they are, were more powerful than any human. No human could rise above the gods. And you had, of course, back in those days, too, you had this idea that some humans were like semi-gods. You had Hercules, whose father was Zeus, right? Or where you had that kind of stuff going on. But you had humans down here. We're down here. The gods are up here. Some of them are more powerful than others, but they're all more powerful than us because we're just human. That's, again, just an assumption. That's just the way it is. Nothing's random. You have bad crop. It was Athena, or whatever. Yeah. You had an earthquake. It was the gods, the vengeance of the gods. So it was all, this is the way the world was. Humans were expected to serve and placate the gods in order for humans to be safe and prosperous. Now I can read history, and you can read history, and we can say, well, this is the way the world was. And it was. What's interesting to me, because I'm doing this not because I'm so interested in history, although I am, I'm interested in history because I want to understand the Bible. What's interesting and what I've learned, and whether you agree or don't agree, I'll just present, the Bible doesn't take issue with this worldview. The Bible doesn't really take issue with it. And that was a surprise. The world, the Bible takes the position, yeah, this is the way the world works. Although there are some slight differences in emphasis, but the Bible doesn't argue with the fact that this is the way the whole world works. Israel has its own God, and that God's different, and should be different. But the Bible doesn't have a problem with this. It says, David says, before the gods, I'll sing praise to you. There's gods. There's these gods of the other nations. Some gods are more powerful than others. That was common, and the Bible doesn't take issue with that either. Gods are more powerful than humans. The Bible doesn't take issue with that as well. Nothing is random. Now the Bible does take issue with that a little bit. There is time and chance, the Bible says. In the ancient world, that wasn't typically a popular idea that there can be random actions or time and chance. Humans are expected to serve and placate gods. Well, yes and no. I've gone over this before, but the gods of the nations want the attention. They want service. They want people to serve them. And that's the way the ancient accounts are written. In the Bible, as I've gone over before, God, Yahweh, he doesn't need us in that sense. He doesn't need us to stroke his ego or whatever. The lesser gods do. The Bible is full of references to lesser gods. It uses the term, a Greek term, daimon, I guess, daimon, something like that in English letters. And we are used to calling them demons because that's what the word looks like. And we picture them as impish kind of creatures or whether they can cause trouble. I think in the biblical worldview, a better term would be godlings or lesser gods. It's not just little troublemakers. It's powerful. It can, in some cases, very powerful beings that are, they're not the god, but they are gods and they have power. Why to talk about this? Because there was a worldview at the time the Bible was written about how the spirit world worked. And I don't know what that picture is supposed to be or how it got in there. But we'll go here. This is the academy in Athens, and there's supposed to be 12 gods, but I think one of them is down here and one of them is down here. It gets so narrow that they don't bother putting the other two, I think. These are supposed to be the gods from Mount Olympus. They look very human to me, but that's the way the gods were. It's supposed to be the 12. How did the Greeks, for instance, or the Romans, because the Romans had a Greek culture in a lot of ways, and the Roman Empire was a lot of Greek culture after Alexander's time. How did they refer to their gods? How did they, you know, what kind of words did they use to talk about the gods? And I'm sure there are lots and lots of words, but what words did they use? One of them is, I didn't look up how to say it, something like semnos. All right, and it's a word that means in Greek to be worthy of respect or dignified. And that's a word that, if you look it up in the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, the first thing they say about that word is that it's first an attribute of the gods. It's lofty. It's something that belongs in the realm of the gods. All right, that's the origin of that word. I could go into more detail, and I don't really understand it all, but some of it has to do with being deserving of reverence or worship, that type of thing. So, although they certainly had plenty of stories about their gods that made them sound like humans, that did very human things, in the end, the gods were up there, and humans are down here. And the gods are worthy of worship. Just like, you know, we say God, we sing the song, worthy of worship, worthy of praise. Well, that's the way they felt about all their gods, all of them. And they used this term, semnos, to refer to the dignity or loftiness of these gods. That's one of the words they use. That's the word we're going to focus. It has to do with something that's of the gods or heavenly, okay? So it's a different plane, it's a different level. It also has some other meanings. I'm saying other meanings. The way I'm basing this on, again, the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, which traces this word throughout Greek writing. How did the Greeks use this word? What did it mean to them? Well, sometimes it just meant attributes of the gods that only the gods had. But they could also use, by extension, they used this word to talk about objects. Objects that had some kind of majesty or greatness, okay? An example for that, you can't tell here, that's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. It's some fine music. They could use this word to describe music. It had some kind of majesty to it. Some kind of it made feelings. You could maybe not worship the music, but it put you in that frame of mind. You could revere the music, whatever. So they also use the word in that way. Again, it's connected to the gods, but there's some human things that have some of those qualities too. It could also be an inner majesty, it's like a character, some kind of character or virtue, okay, that anything can have, but also people can have. And when it comes to men, they could also use the term of certain men or women who were dignified and in positions of where they had to be respected, just like we would say like Queen Elizabeth was, that she had a dignity about her and she was revered in many ways all around the world, especially by those in the Commonwealth and in her country. So these are different ways that the Greeks used this word semnos, which I have up there with the small s, and it's a word that appears in the Bible, or wouldn't be taking all this time. So let's look at it in more detail. How is this word used in the Bible? So I wanted to give you some background there. I wanted to give you a background of, you know, when Paul chooses to use this word, or someone else, James chooses to use the word, or a form of the word. What were they thinking of? What was their approach? What was they're writing to somebody? What are the people on the other end going to get out of this? Well, that's why I gave you the background. They're going to get this. They're going to get something of the gods, maybe. That's one of the uses of the word. Something about the majesty of an object or a musical production or something like that. Even oratory. They were into oratory and debates and things in the Roman Empire. That was one of the things that could have a certain majesty or greatness. Also people. You know, this is the way that the people who received Paul's letters, the people who received a letter from James, whatever, they knew this is what the Greek means, okay? So this is how the words could be used, not necessarily used in all these ways, but could be. So how's this word used in the Bible? Let's look at that, take a few minutes to look at this word in the Bible. And of course, where I'm going to go first is Philippians chapter 4 and verse 8, as we're going to continue looking at these verses 8 and 9. Finally, brethren, whatsoever is true, whatsoever is whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there's any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. The things you have learned, received, and heard, and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. So there's the word right there. Whatever is honorable. Honorable. That's semnos. All right? Honorable. Or it's a form of that, whether it's the adjective or the noun or whatever. Semnos. Whatever is true. Whatever is honorable. And you notice, as we go through these things, there's a lot of overlap between the terms. And I think that's on purpose. We'll discuss that more in the future, but you know, Paul could have made sure he said some different things, but these are a cluster of words and meanings that are tied together in a certain way. We're going to see that the more as we go through. So today's sermon, today's message is the second part of dwell on these things. This time it's whatever's honorable. Whatever's honorable, that word semnos. We're going to focus on that one today. In the Bible, again, how is it used? You could say, how about of the gods? That's the first meaning there. Well, it turns out the Bible doesn't use it that way. That's the way the Greeks used it, and that's the primary meaning, that this is of the gods. But the Bible doesn't use the term to refer to God the Father or Jesus. And there's a reason for that. I'm not sure that I know the reason. I would submit to you that it's because to the Jewish mind, to our mind, to the Christian mind, there's no comparison between the God that we worship and all the other gods. Because the other gods are godlings, they're lesser gods. They're you know, we call them demons. I think that's probably the wrong term, but they are they are a lesser creation. And God's not a creation. So the Bible does not use this term of God, and I think on purpose. Somehow I repeated that one. There we go. So we're going to cross that one out. The Bible does not use that aspect of the term semnos to refer. It doesn't use that to refer to God the Father, to God. How about of objects, of things? Well, it turns out the Bible doesn't use that meaning either. Because the way that works, of course, is if the gods are able to be described by that word, then the things that are associated with the gods, I guess you could say, that, you know, whether it's his idol or her idol or the temple or a sacrifice, like those things then also by connection with the gods, they can have this word applied to them. Since the Bible doesn't apply this word to those lesser gods, then these things that are associated with the lesser gods don't get referred to that way either. So we rule those two out, because this word's not used to talk about God or the things of God. So how is it used? You know, because it does appear in the Bible a few times. Well, it has to do with inner majesty, virtue, you know, what's going on inside, and dignity and being worthy of respect. Those meanings are those are the ways that these words are used, or this word is used in the Bible. So let's take a closer look at the examples, and there's not a lot of them. We get to look at them all. First of all, you know, when I spoke last time, we talked about whatever's true, all right? And there's a lot of words, a lot of meanings of true, just things that are true as opposed to false, but also it's a quality of character. Moral excellence, so it's a way of life, it's an understanding of what God's doing. And you'll notice, and you probably already have noticed, that this idea of a virtue, of a dignity, of an inner quality, it's very much like one of the meanings of truth and the way true is used. So again, we'll see they tie together, and this isn't the last time that's going to happen. And that ought to tell us something too, that there's certain things that were very important to Paul, and he's repeating them. He's using different words, but the different words sometimes are saying the same thing because they're important. So we're talking about quality of character here, and with honorable, things that are honorable, we are talking about a quality of character. Same thing. In Titus chapter 2 and verses 1 through 5, he says, but as for you, speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. Older men, all right? So some of us here are older men. Older men are to be temperate, dignified, that's the word, that's semnos, sensible, sound in faith, in love, in perseverance. So that's supposed to be describing us. I mean, how well does it describe us, old men? I can look at that saying, not too well. I don't know how dignified I am. And I don't. It's not about acting dignified. It's about being dignified. Does that make it? You know, there's a difference. You can't act. You can't put it on. You know, you strut around, but that doesn't work. We're supposed to be temperate, dignified, sensible, sound in faith and love and in perseverance. That's a tall order. But that's supposed to describe us as older men. It talks about the young men later. Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips or enslaved to much wine. So some of us are older women. Teaching what is good, so that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. That's a long list there. Now, Paul's got lots of lists, but this one seems to be harder on the women than the men. It's got a lot of things here. And the older women are supposed to have learned something, are supposed to be able to pass it on to the younger women. And some of us are better at that than others. My mom's not here anymore, and I'm going to bring her up a couple of times. I didn't plan on it here, but my mom, one of her endearing qualities that I learned from hearing it from other people, from other women who were much younger, like my age, when she passed and different people would say, well, your mom was really special to me. You know, I'm talking somebody my age, you know, being 25 years younger than my mother or 23, wherever it was. And they said, you know, mom, your mom used to come over and talk to me. Or she'd write me a note or a card, or she made sure she spent time with me. And that was my mom fulfilling this verse here. Teaching the young women, not that she taught, she was like, hey, you need to do this, you need to do that, but by her example and her friendship, she was teaching what is good. She did that in our home. She taught what is good, and mostly by example. She was a very gentle teacher. My dad, not. I'm more like my dad in the way that I raised my children. But my mom was very gentle and had a way of, even my wife, who, you know, Shelby, not going to be nice here how to say this, but my mom could say things to Shelby that were somewhat corrective in a way that Shelby didn't feel corrected. That's like totally foreign language to me. I have no idea how you do that, but my wife felt comfortable when my mother would point out something in a, you know, something that maybe Shelby could improve on. I haven't found, you know, how to do that with anybody yet very well, but my mom had that gift and that talent, and some of you probably have that. It's not something I grew up with. I have to work on that. But anyway, my mom was a good example there, and because she took time to interact with people, and in that sense, she was dignified. She was dignified. And people held her in high esteem, especially young women held her in high esteem. That's not the rest of the verb. We got a little bit more. But this is the list there. We got temperate, sensible, sound in faith, in love, in perseverance, reverent in their behavior. Some of these things are for men, some are women, but they apply to all of us. Not malicious gossips. I don't know if that's saying that all gossip is malicious or if it's only malicious gossip we're not allowed to do. I tend to think it means that gossips are malicious in general. Not enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good. That's a long list, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. That's so much there. That's so much. Temperate and sensible. you know, does that describe you? Unfortunately, it doesn't describe me as much as it should. Talking about that this morning in a different sermon in Lewistown. But, you know, we fight what we are, you know, what we're given, what we're born with. And God wants us to be different than that. It's, you know, the old, just as I am is okay at first, but then eventually, you know, we're to change. We're to become something different and become more godly in our behavior. And Paul lists these, or this is in Titus, but Paul lists these things in many occasions. But let's finish this in Titus. I didn't put it here, but here's the last two verses there. Likewise, urge young men to be sensible. So that's the same thing that older men are supposed to be. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds with purity in doctrine, dignified. Even young men are to be dignified. I'm thinking maybe as I get close to 70, I might be starting to get a little dignity. I'm not really sure, but I'm trying. I didn't have any hope at when I was young. There was no dignity there. But that's the ideal. That's the ideal. I'm sure that my parents were shaking their heads, but you know, and hope and praying that someday maybe I'd learn, and I hope I have. Sound speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Well, I can't say that in my life opponents have had nothing bad to say about me. So we got this, you know, we're to be good examples. We have purity in doctrine, sound speech, all of those things. Let's look at 1 Timothy chapter 3. I read four verses, but you see where the dignity is. It's a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, he's talking about pastors, bishops, it's a fine work that he desires to do. An overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. And that's that word again, semnos. And a lot of times in our church culture, we've applied this to elders in general, but it's specifically talking about leaders of the church, leaders of a congregation. And that's a tall order. You look at that, it's like, well, how do you find anybody? You know, it's a lot of things there. But the dignity here in particular refers to dignity in family life. And some of you are just wonderful examples there. You know, I learned from the examples of others. I haven't had the same approach in my family over the years, and I'm learning. Dignity in family life. Talks about deacons, deaconesses, what we call deaconesses. Deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued, or addicted to much wine, or fond of sordid gain. And you know, I don't know what it was like in that culture exactly. You didn't have all the money-making opportunities we have in today's world, but we have a lot of, as you know, we're all aware, especially in our country, we have, because it's possible to be successful and to do well and be prosperous, we have some people that's what they live for. They live to have the gain. And this refers to it as sordid gain. Nothing wrong with having good things, but here, you know, obviously the implication is we're taking advantage of other people to get what we want. And that's not being a man of dignity when it talks about the deacons. And then it talks about their wives, as women must likewise be dignified. So this is the way that the New American Standard translates this word, but it's the semnos. It's talking about an inner dignity, a way that somebody carries themselves. And again, not malicious gossips, but temperate and faithful in all things. I'll talk about this now. I can go back to my mom for a minute. Paul's saying, I want you to think about these kinds of things. I want you to think about things that are true, and not just, you know, true as opposed to false, but things that have to do with the inner character, with what's good. And the second thing he mentions is things that are honorable, which again is talking about this dignity, these inner qualities. And that's hard to do in our world. Apparently it was hard to do in his world. He wouldn't have had to write those verses. But they didn't have cable news. They didn't have so much negativity that's just broadcast everywhere like we have in our world. And it gets worse because we have people in general, humans, we have an addiction to being entertained in some way or another. And sometimes it's entertainment with news. Sometimes it's entertainment with entertainment, if you want to call it that. But we want to be fed all this information. And this information works on our brains. And it was no different back then. It's just I think it's fair to say that it's intensified. But humans have always been humans. You know, we went back at the flood. And God looked at things pretty bad. Well, they're still pretty bad. It's just that things happen at a quicker pace and there's more pressure, more intense pressure with some of the negativity of being humans and then what we do to each other and how we do it. Because we can spread it around and pay attention to it. But as I mentioned last time too, it depends on what we let into our brains. And I want to use my mom as an example again. She died in the 90s. But as she was sick, you know, we're there trying to keep her company and just spend time with her. Different people come visit. And Shelby and I were there a lot. And I can remember two times with me, and I don't know if how much it was with other people, but I can remember two times where I wanted to bring up something, just conversation, something I thought she'd be interested in. But it involved something that to her was negative. I wasn't trying to, one of them might have involved bad news. The other one just involved a situation or a person who was involved in a situation that was negative, and I wasn't referring to that. But my mom, on each occasion, the one time I was bringing up stuff in our church life in those years, this was 1993, and I brought up something about something in the church in that context for those of you that were around then. And my mom, I don't think she said anything. She just kind of went like this. Don't talk about that. I don't want to listen. I don't want to hear it. She can't get up and walk away at that point. She just went, she didn't want to hear it. And I had to respect that, of course, but also learn something. That, she was facing certain things in her own life, and she wanted to be positive. She wanted to think about her future. She wanted to think about good. And that, whatever I was going to bring up at the time, or whatever I started to bring up, that wasn't going to be good, and that wasn't going to be positive. And she didn't want to hear it. It's like turning off the TV. She wasn't a TV watcher. But not that kind. Well, you didn't have cable news. You didn't have that kind of stuff back then. But maybe by that time you had some cable news. Not quite as much. But she turned me off. No, bro. On two occasions, there probably were others, but there's two that stick in my mind. And the other time I wanted to talk about, it was actually a person, somebody in her life, in her circle, in my circle. And just gave me that, like, no, I don't want to talk about that now. And I realized then, but now, as I get older, more so, that my mom recognized that you only have so much brain power going. And if she were to take that brain power, and I'm not saying she was deficient, she wasn't, but if I take my brain and I focus on this negative stuff over here, I can't be focusing on positive stuff at the same time. And she chose, to focus on the positive. I try to do that more. Again, the older I get, I wasn't always that way, though. And we, as a people, aren't generally that way. We find a lot to criticize and a lot that's negative. And I'm talking about our culture here in the United States. And we want to complain and we want to blame somebody for all of our problems. And as my brother mentioned to me this week, he says, yeah, he was talking about something. He said, yeah, and half of us blame the other half. And each blame, you know, it's roughly half, and we blame each other. As Christians, we don't need to get into that argument at all. This isn't God's world in that sense, not the culture, not the society. So we've talked about that before. I wanted to share that about my mom because she was way ahead of her time, and way ahead of me in her time, put it that way. I didn't really get it. I respected what she said. I quit talking about the negative things. But in my life, I didn't recognize until many, many years later that I needed to try in my own brain to have less negative stuff there and more positive stuff. And that's part of what this dignity is. Is that dignity has to do with our relationship to what's above. And you know, my mom wanted to have her mind on that, not what's going on down here. Not that, you know, we have to pay attention some. You know, you gotta watch on the road where you're driving, we have to take care of ourselves. But that's not our life. You know, her life, she realized that her life's somewhere else. This is not her home. This is not my home. It's not your home. Not now. We look forward to a time when it will be. But we're what's it say? The Bible refers to us as sojourners, as like the patriarchs were. We're kind of like refugees. We don't have a home yet. We're not home yet, put it that way. And I think the more that we recognize that, the better off we are. All right, I've looked at all the scriptures in the New Testament to use that word. Let's look at the Old Testament, the Septuagint, the Greek translation, because that's what Paul had, that's what James had, that's what these people had. They had this Greek translation. Well, Paul would have been, his first language was probably Greek, so he's reading scripture in Greek. And where is this word, semnos, used in the Septuagint? That's only two places. And they're both in Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 6. Listen, for I will speak noble things. Noble is the word that's translated semnos into Greek. And the opening the opening of my lips will reveal right things. So here we get the word noble in English that the translators of the... this is again an English translation of the Septuagint, but it's that same word. But this time it's used as noble things. So again, noble, what's that mean? Well, it's above the riffraff, all right? We stand above, not because we're better, but because we choose our minds focused on what's above. And that gets back to the original definition of this word, it has to do with the gods. Well, the Bible doesn't use it in term of all the gods, but it has to do with having a higher level of consciousness, if you want to put it that way, that our minds are on different things than the typical world citizen. In Proverbs 15:26, we have, evil plans are an abomination to the Lord, but pleasant words are pure. Pure is the word, semnos again. Pleasant words are pure. So we live in a world that doesn't have a lot of pleasant words. And you know, Paul in Philippians chapter 4, he's talking about a peace that he wants us to be able to have, you to have, me to have. And he's saying if we have our minds on these kinds of things, we can have that peace. So that's good. So this is the only two times in the Septuagint. Only times we see those words. So if we go back to Philippians chapter 4. Again, whatever's true, honorable. This is New American Standard Translation. Pure, lovely, good repute, any excellence, anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. Then the things that you have learned and received and heard and seen in me. So Paul was using himself as an example. Practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. And we don't live in a peaceful world. We don't live, we live in a world that's not at peace at all. But thinking of things that are honorable will help us focus on peace. So what have we covered? Well, in biblical usage, when something or someone is honorable, we're talking about inner qualities. We're not talking about pretense. We're not talking about somebody can make themselves look a certain way, but what's going on the inside? What's real? What's real? These are things like virtue. Doing the right thing and having the right approach and the right attitude. Dignity. These are the words, again, the Bible uses. And being what? Being worthy of respect. Not that we're worthy of anything that God gives us, but even as a human being, we can be worthy of respect by our behavior. Being noble. Again, a little bit different plane. Being pure. Try to keep ourselves unspotted from the world, it says in James. The world spots everything. It's like the dogs. We got these dogs, right? They got longish hair. We don't keep them cut. And sometimes they find a muddy spot in the yard somewhere, and they go get all muddy. And there are places they can come into the house. It's downstairs. My office is downstairs. And if I don't catch it in time, they will come in all wet and muddy and come into my office and decide that's where they shake. And you've had dogs, you know. Their shaking is a really efficient thing. It gets quite a bit of the moisture off of them. And it gets all over my cabinets and all over everything. And that, you know, that's the way the world is. The world contaminates us. So what do we do? Well, we can't. God doesn't ask us to leave the world, but he asks us to disengage our brains from the world so that we can be honorable, because the world's not, in general, honorable. Not that there aren't people that do honorable things, but... So what's the result? If we would just do this, if we would dwell on the things that are true and honorable, you know, to pick the first two, it says then in verse 9, that the things you've learned, received, and heard, and seen in me, practice these things. So we need to do them. It's partly just what we think. It's partly what we think about, but it's also partly what we do. Do these things. Practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. And God gives us peace. It's not a peaceful world. It's not. People are not peaceful. The world is not peaceful. But God wants us to have peace. I didn't put it here. Isaiah, what is it, 26:3? You will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. In other words, we keep our mind on God and what he's doing, and God will keep us in peace. So the world needs peace, and it's God's intention that it start with us. We're like, you know, the king. We represent the kingdom. We represent... We're ambassadors, we're citizens of the kingdom. And if we have that peace, it's obvious to other people, and they'll see it. So let's dwell on these things. We've only covered two, but let's dwell on these things. Dwell on these things, and the inner peace will come, and then we can be an example of what God's kingdom will be like when peace will envelop the whole world.